Thank you for downloading this podcast from File on 4. For more information about BBC podcasts, please go to bbc.co.uk/podcasts.
As the private finance initiative comes under increased parliamentary scrutiny, File on 4 delves into a secretive world where PFI shareholdings in hospitals, roads, prisons and schools are bought and sold. The profits can be huge.
I was working as a consultant with a construction company, and they were making far more money selling the PFI deals on afterwards than they were on the actual construction.
Information about these sales on a so-called secondary market can be hard to pin down, even for the government. But we've been given access to a database covering more than 600 trades in PFI shares and revealing some of the sums involved.
I think it's a wealth machine. It's a way of actually not necessarily printing money, but it's virtually that, given the scale of these profits.
So what does this mean about the price we taxpayers are paying for some PFI contracts? Senior coalition ministers from the Prime Minister down have criticised some deals in scathing terms. One says private sector negotiators must have been laughing all the way to the bank. So were they?
When PFI equity sales are criticised as a wealth machine, how do you respond?
Well, I just don't agree with that. We operate within a business narrative. We are investors and contractors that have taken advantage of opportunities to deliver projects.
I'm going on in.
When patients arrive at the Queen Alexandra Hospital in Portsmouth, they're swept through revolving doors like the entrance to a supermarket into a bright, open reception area. It's about as far as you could get from a traditional Victorian red brick NHS institution. The Queen Alexandra opened 2 years ago as a regional showpiece for the benefits of the private finance initiative. It's a bold landmark of 21st century design. When the Prime Minister was asked a parliamentary question about the new hospital at Portsmouth, he took the occasion to dismiss PFI in general as a shambles. It's not the architecture that troubles him, it's the cost. In Portsmouth, that's £44 million a year the hospital trust has to find until 2040, rising with inflation, to pay for the Queen Alexandra. The Trust admits that it faces significant financial challenges. Since the hospital opened, it has shed 700 jobs, with a further 99 to go, and it's cut 100 beds. It decided to close a small specialist unit, Ward G5, for patients in the last days of their lives, who need intensive palliative and nursing care.
Local people were frankly outraged about it. About 10,000 people signed a petition against the ward closure, and it resulted in an independent government review of the closure.
Will Purvis has led a local campaign of protest, arguing that the closure of Ward G5 means less specialist attention for dying patients.
End of life is very difficult. We're talking about the last 48 hours of someone's life. It's a very difficult time for them and a very difficult time for their family. Having them on a specialist unit where they can have a room to themselves, the family can stay with them the whole of that last period, there's no issues with visiting hours, there's no disturbance from other people and other visitors around them.
And how much of that has been lost?
All of that, frankly. The replacement system basically means that they'll be treated on a general care ward. They cannot guarantee that they'll be given in an individual room. They will be subject to the same sorts of visiting hours as a normal ward. And there's not that very specialist care from the staff who dealt with end of life every single day of the week. Now, those few staff are expected to train all of the staff in the hospital, which they're just never going to be able to deliver the same level of care.
The hospital defended its plan to close Ward G5 by pointing out that it wasn't big enough for the number of patients needing it, and insisting that care would be of high standard in the new arrangement. But Will Purvis and his fellow protesters believe that the key factor was the £600,000 a year the hospital would save, and they blame the cost of the PFI deal.
I think there's a direct link. It's undoubtable that this was a financially led decision because, quite frankly, the independent review has found that there was no coherent plan in place for what was going to replace it. You don't make a clinical decision without knowing what you're trying to achieve clinically. And the main reason for needing to make a financial decision to save £0.6 million a year is quite simply the fact that this £40 million repayment exists and there's a massive operational deficit with the hospital.
The hospital presents its closure decision as a clinical necessity. The chief executive is on record denying any financial link. But last December, the manager of the department concerned seemed to tell Hampshire County councillors at a select committee hearing that there was a financial dimension to the decision. So can the hospital's chief executive, Ursula Ward, clarify this apparent discrepancy?
G5 only had 14 beds, and the reality is a lot more patients actually die in a hospital. So what we wanted to do was make sure that all patients got access to equal services and good quality of care. And of course, with only 14 beds, not everybody was able to do that.
And you're telling me there was no financial dimension to that?
Absolutely no financial dimension.
Why did one of your managers say that there was then to Hampshire County Council? He said, although there was a financial dimension to the decision, what led it was a clinical view.
This decision was very much clinically driven.
But then you're at odds with one of your own managers, aren't you?
I think you're misinterpreting how that was reported in the press.
While Portsmouth Hospital struggles to meet its financial obligations, including the £44 million a year for its PFI, the company that built the hospital has done very nicely out of the deal. 5 years ago, the Midlands construction firm Carillion put in half the original capital for the project. And last year, it decided to sell its 50% stake in the equity. The buyer was an infrastructure company which now has the right to charge for cleaning, catering, maintenance and other services over the next 29 years. We asked Carillion to tell us what price it got for the shareholding and what level of profit that represented on its original investment. In a long reply, the company doesn't give any figures and says only that the profit was not excessive. But an academic at Edinburgh University has tracked down the details. Mark Hellowell has been able to fill in the blanks on the deal struck over shares in the Portsmouth Hospital.
Carillion was the lead equity investor. They put in £12 million. It opened in July 2009, and last June Carillion sold its stake in the deal for £31 million. So it put in £12.1 million just a few years ago, and it sold that stake for £31 million last June.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
It's a very substantial rate of return, and it's illustrative of the kind of profitability that can be earned on these schemes.
The company that paid the £31 million, HSBC Infrastructure, seems to regard it as a more than fair price. A company presentation to investors cites this as a model case. So if the buyer and the seller are both happy, the substantial profit made by Carillion on its shareholding raises an obvious question. Was the original contract agreed for Portsmouth's PFI hospital too generous to the private sector? Did it have too big a margin built into it? Despite our request, no Treasury Minister was available for interview. But the hospital's chief executive, Ursula Ward, did agree to discuss the terms of the deal and the subsequent sale of Carillion's shareholding, about which hospital managers were consulted.
There isn't a requirement for them to consult with us, but in the interest of partnership working, because we're clearly tied into this partnership for the next 35 years, we were indeed informed of that.
What did you say about it?
It's not got any significant implications for us at all, so, you know, we don't have any concerns around that at all. So they did, absolutely, they did inform us that that was their intention.
A large profit was made by Carillion in that sale. Did that indicate that there was some overpricing in the original PFI contract, if they could take that large profit out and yet another company thought it was worth keeping the contract on?
Okay, well, let's go back to when the business case for this redevelopment was agreed by Treasury. Remember, it had to stand the rules of scrutiny in terms of value for money. We've since had a couple of independent reviews undertaken, both of which have concluded that at the time we negotiated the deal, we got very favourable interest rates. So I'm very confident that we've got a very good rate.
And you got value for money in the original contract, did you?
Absolutely. It wouldn't have got through Treasury approval unless we could demonstrate value for money.
How was there then enough slack in the contract for Carillion to take out millions of pounds and still have HSBC run the contract?
You'd have to ask them.
Carillion have not made anyone available for interview, and nor have HSBC Infrastructure. The sale of Carillion shares was an example of an area of trading which has grown up over less than a decade. New companies have sprung up specifically to hold portfolios of PFI projects. This development has been monitored by Mark Hellowell in Edinburgh.
An investment in a PFI project may be an equity investment, i.e. it's an investment of share capital plus a certain type of loans which go into these projects in order to provide some capital for the facility to be built. Once that facility has been built, these equities can then be sold in what's called the secondary market.
So a company gets a contract to build a school or a hospital. They build it, and then what?
They build it, and then they have an asset, which is, in a sense, the right to earn a revenue stream from that project and the concession that relates to it. Now, that asset can then be bought and sold in the markets in much the same way as any other equity asset.
And that's a guaranteed income, a guaranteed stream of revenue over, well, for some of these contracts, it's 30 or 35 years, isn't it?
It's guaranteed in the sense that it's a fixed income. These are long-term, stable concessions backed by a government that is ultimately underpinning and underwriting these contracts. It's a very low-risk, stable investment which offers a very good rate of return for a long period of time.
And that might look attractive for someone else to buy, might it?
Yes, I think it looks very attractive for someone else to buy. There is still sufficient fat or surplus in these schemes for new investors to come in and make an acceptable rate of return.
Mark Hellowell's conclusion will be made known to influential MPs. He's the special advisor to the House of Commons Treasury Select Committee, which has just held a hearing on PFI. And the Public Accounts Committee is also concerned at suggestions that the taxpayer has had poor value for money out of PFI. The Liberal Democrat MP, Ian Swales, who's a member of that committee, is eager to find out how the secondary market can prove so lucrative for the private sector.
One of the phenomena we've now seen is that we've got what you might call aggregators who are sitting on large numbers of PFI deals. Instead of having all these different deals for different hospitals and different schools and so on, we find actually there are a much smaller number of players who now actually own all these PFI deals behind the hospitals and schools because they've bought up the PFI deals and they're aggregating them into large funds. When you think about it, we're talking about the taxpayer here. So if intermediaries have been able to make large profits, well, almost by definition, that means the taxpayer got a bad deal at the start. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been these super profits to be made.
To put it crudely, do you mean that the original contracts had so much slack or fat in them that it's been possible for people to take profits out and still have a contract that makes sense for somebody to run?
Well, exactly. And when you think about it, all we're talking about is long-term cash flows that come out of the pockets of the taxpayers. So the fact that these contracts have been specified in the way that they have, almost by definition, you can say that was not a good deal. It was too generous to the provider of the PFI. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been possible for people to make large sums of money by selling them on. I was working as a consultant with a construction company, and they were making far more money selling the PFI deals on afterwards than they were on the actual construction. So, you know, yes, I think people could see it was open season, and, you know, we're having to pick up the pieces now.
Working out the level of profit being made selling PFI shareholdings is no easy task when there's no requirement on companies to make it public. This lends an air of secrecy to many trades in the secondary PFI market. And where there's secrecy, there's usually a persistent analyst trying to get to the facts.
What we have here is a database which identifies the companies that have been involved in the origins of PFI schemes and the time, date, the value of the sale, and where possible I've identified the profits that are being made on these equity sales.
Dexter Whitfield runs a research group called the European Services Strategy Unit. He's combed Companies House, individual annual reports and stock exchange notices to compile a vast spreadsheet of 622 trades in PFI shareholdings. Given the taciturn nature of many companies, it's far from comprehensive. But Dexter Whitfield has found profit figures for more than 100 equity sales and compared them with the average annual profits the industry could expect.
The profit levels are astronomical. As part of the database, I've got 154 examples where we've got detailed, solid profit levels, which are not from newspapers or anything else. They're from the companies and financial institutions themselves. The average profit is 50.6%. But if you compare the 50.6% profit level with the average profit of the major construction companies over the last 6 to 7 years, which is basically about 2.8%, the 50.6 is in stark contrast.
Which area of PFI has been the most profitable?
PFI and health. The building of major hospitals has been an average profit on the equity sales to date of 66.7%. Transport, education are slightly below the average, but if you take education, which is about 34%.
Building schools.
Yes, building new schools. Even taking that as the lowest one, that is still, you know, a massive leap from the 2.8% average the construction profit in recent years. I think it's a wealth machine. It's a way of actually not necessarily printing money, but it's virtually that, given the scale of these profits.
The sum of profits reported on this sample of 154 sales of PFI equity is over £500 million. No one knows the true total figure for all sales. Of course, it may be useful for a construction company to sell its long-term interest in a PFI contract to free up cash it needs now for new projects. And there's nothing inherently wrong in another company buying PFI shares. The critical question is the price and the level of profit involved. David Metter, chairman of the PPP Forum, believes both are proving reasonable. He speaks for scores of construction firms, finance houses and professional advisers involved in PFI projects.
Well, I'm not sure I agree that there have been vast profits made out of equity sales.
Well, 67% in hospitals, 50% in criminal justice. These are the profits on sales, 34% in schools. They're pretty good profit rates, aren't they?
Well, if I can just step back, most of the equity sales today happen between primary investors, investors who've invested in the early stage of projects, into secondary funds. And the equity that arrives in the secondary funds is going to stay there probably until the concessions run out.
If it really is the case that you've got equity profits of something over 50% on average, that's a very good return, isn't it?
Well, can I just go back to the use of percentages again? We rather use multiples when we look at the profitability of PFI projects. And I would say in today's market that if you buy an equity investment from a primary investor who's held this investment for 6 years, the project has been built and he's held it for 2 years into operation, and the secondary investor comes along and buys that investment, he is likely to receive between 1.5 times and 2 times the amount of equity he put in.
Well, if he gets 2 times, that's the same as 50% profit, isn't it?
Well, yes. So if he put in £10 million, he would get back £20 million after 6 years.
But that's a very high rate of return, much higher than the construction industry would expect in its normal business.
Well, the equity takes the highest risk in the project capital structure.
When PFI equity sales are criticised as a wealth machine, how do you respond?
Well, I just don't agree with that.
The analyst Dexter Whitfield has used his database to estimate the total value of PFI equity sales to date. His figure is just short of £10 billion. but he's concerned that the government isn't keeping track of events. The Treasury maintains an online database listing hundreds of PFI projects. For each, it itemises annual payments over the decades of the contract, and in some cases, lists the equity sales which have taken place. But, as Dexter Whitfield has discovered, there are some glaring gaps in the government's information. So what's come up now, this is the Treasury's own database.
This is the Treasury's own database. And you will see from the just the, when we start here, we've got projects on the left here, and you move along, there's the value of the contract, but then it says equity holder, change of ownership since August 2008, etc. But all these white spaces means that they don't have any information.
And how many projects have the Treasury got no information about?
When I last did an analysis earlier this year, it was 68 projects.
That they knew nothing about?
That's right. And that's what we need. We need the information about when it was sold and what it was sold for, the amount of money, and what profit levels were involved.
The project on Dexter Whitfield's database, which has been traded more times than any other, is here in Halifax. It's the Calderdale Royal Hospital, another fine example of modern design, set among the stone terraces of the town and serving the population of this area of Yorkshire. Over the past 9 years, this hospital has been through a remarkable series of PFI equity trades involving companies in France, Scotland, the Netherlands, England and Australia. Quite a history, which Dexter Whitfield has succeeded in uncovering. And he seems to know rather more about it than the government does.
What this shows is that Lendlease Corporation was a key financier of the project early on. We can start with 2002. Lendlease Corporation sold 30.1% share to Quayle Munro Holdings, PLC. Lendlease retained 20%.
And you got that information from where?
I got that information from the Lendlease Corporation annual account for 2002, page 7.
And the Treasury didn't seem to know that?
The Treasury didn't know that. Lendlease is a major Australian-based transnational company.
So 2005, 60% of the equity was sold on one occasion, 30% on another, 16.7% on another. These are sales and resales, presumably.
That's right, that's right.
And then 2006, 50%, 3%, 20%. These are sales and sales again. And the most recent one is?
2010, when Lendlease Corporation sets up a separate infrastructure fund with a Dutch PGGM, which is a Dutch pension fund administrator. They set up a separate company to manage these assets.
And altogether from the years 2002 to 2010, there have been how many sales of equity in Calderdale
Hospital?
There's been
nine different transactions.
Nine transactions?
Yes.
And yet the Treasury had recorded none of them?
That's right.
We asked each of the companies involved in buying or selling shares in Calderdale Royal Hospital to tell us the price involved and the profit level. None of them has done so, citing commercial confidentiality. And there's no requirement for them to reveal this information, even to the government, though this is a publicly funded hospital. Companies trading in PFI equity are allowed to maintain a considerable degree of secrecy about their activities. This troubles the financial watchdogs at the National Audit Office. 6 weeks ago, they published a report on the lessons from PFI projects. It raises precisely this concern.
When investors sell their shares in project companies to other investors, there is little transparency of the price at which these shareholdings are bought or sold, or the impact of these transactions on investors' returns. This is an issue we expect to return to in our future work.
Not for the first time, the author of this NAO report, David Finlay, sees lack of transparency, a polite way of saying secrecy, as a problem facing those trying to monitor the finances of PFI deals.
At the moment, there is no general requirement for the profits on selling shares to be disclosed. There may be people who surmise that investors are making great profits, but we simply don't have the overall perspective at the moment.
The National Audit Office first raised concern about this in a report in 2006. It's 5 years later now. Have you been slow to act on this?
No, not at all. This has been an area which we have continually returned to.
And since 2006, there's been no progress, has there, in greater transparency?
There has been a small amount of progress in the sense that on new PFI contracts, the public sector has a right to call for information on the investor's current experience of the whole project. But this has not as yet put a large amount of further information into the public domain.
Do you expect there to be some progress on this if you've been calling for greater transparency for 5 years? Do you think it may actually happen now?
Well, we have clearly called in our latest report on lessons from PFI and other projects for greater transparency. It's a matter now for the Treasury to work out how that can be achieved.
Again, no Treasury Minister was available for an interview with File on 4. The NAO reports to the Public Accounts Committee with a hearing this week for the umpteenth time on PFI. The committee chair, Margaret Hodge MP, wants to work out whether PFI deals represent value for money to us taxpayers. But she too is stymied by officially sanctioned lack of transparency.
Now there has to be transparency around the system so that if there is some profit over time in the funding of these PFI contracts, that profit can be shared between the taxpayer and the private investor.
But the industry said that's none of your business. These are private sales from one company to another, nothing to do with you, no requirement to give any of it to the taxpayer.
Well, I think the principle is that there should be. This is taxpayers' money, and we have to ensure that there's value for money for the taxpayer out of these construction programmes. And therefore, what we should be doing is building in right at the start, in the way we design the contracts, a mechanism which enables you to share those profits over time. It's all got to be transparent. You've got to know what profit's being made, and you then have a mechanism to bring some money back to taxpayers. So I don't agree with the private sector on that. I think they're making good money out of it, but are they making excessive profits? And if they are, shouldn't that be shared?
This argument has gone on for at least the past 9 years and remains unresolved. The Treasury has supported the private sector's insistence that it should keep the whole of any profits made from PFI equity sales, with none of these gains coming back to the taxpayer. One of the government's reasons is that profits are liable to capital gains tax, so the Exchequer gets a slice of them anyway. But one of the noticeable facts about the funds which have accumulated shareholdings in PFI is how many of them are based in tax havens. Guernsey and Jersey are particularly popular. Nonetheless, the chairman of the PPP Forum, David Metta, argues that the Treasury is right to keep its hands off profits from PFI equity sales.
One has to pay tax on the capital gain, so you're already paying 30% to the taxpayer, like anybody else is on any other security. And the question is whether the public sector should demand more or to increase the taxation on this type of investment activity.
Is tax paid on those capital gains if, as is the case in a large number of infrastructure companies, they're based in a Channel Islands tax haven?
Well, the first thing to say is that all PFI project companies are UK-based, and all these companies pay tax as UK companies.
But their parent companies tend to be based in tax havens. And so what happens then to the capital gains?
Well, I was coming on to that. The next level is the question of the shareholders, the investors, and also the lenders to these project companies. Now, again, we are attracting investment from all over the world, where often the lenders and the equity investors will be based in one tax environment, investing into another tax environment. So they will be looking quite hard at their tax planning and their investment strategy, since tax is a cost to their investment. They look at their net returns, and this was after the deduction of all taxes.
But when you said that tax is paid on these profits from equity sales, if they're based in tax havens, that tax isn't necessarily paid at all, is it?
Well, if the investor is based in a jurisdiction where there's no tax, then they won't pay any tax.
Quite. So when you said that there will be a benefit for the taxpayer from capital gains tax, that's not true if the company's based offshore.
If a company is based offshore, it may not be liable for UK capital gains tax under certain circumstances, but I'm no expert in that area, but my guess is that that will be a matter for tax lawyers.
To clarify this crucial point, we turn to the tax accountant Richard Murphy of the Tax Justice Network, which campaigns against the use of tax havens. We asked him to explain the potential advantages to a PFI equity holder in being based offshore.
In principle, an infrastructure fund that owns shares in private equity projects is liable to capital gains tax if, and it's a very important if, they are resident in the UK. If, of course, the infrastructure fund is located in a tax haven, for example, the Channel Islands, where there is no tax on most companies and there's certainly no tax on capital gains, they avoid that capital gains tax liability altogether, because it is where you own the shares that matters in this case. If those shares are owned outside the UK, even if they are in UK companies, there is no capital gain on their sale.
So when the Treasury gave as one of its reasons for not demanding a slice of profits from equity sales for the taxpayer that in any event capital gains tax would be paid, if the infrastructure company is based offshore, the Treasury was wrong.
The Treasury has shown itself to be remarkably naive with regard to the operation of private equity ownership. So the Treasury seems to be quite oblivious to the fact that UK capital gains tax is residence-based, so it is incredibly easy to get round UK capital gains tax. Simply own the shares in an offshore company, make sure that company is managed offshore, and the company is outside UK tax.
Under the coalition government, the tide has now turned against PFI, or at least the rhetoric has. 70 MPs, most of them on the government side, are campaigning for a PFI rebate from companies who've made big profits. The Treasury has launched a pilot project looking for savings in PFI annual service charges. Its chosen site is Queen's Hospital, Romford, where a team of commercial, legal and technical advisers has been poring over the contract. Any savings they achieve are expected to be announced later this month. But if the government's language has raised expectations of big cuts in PFI charges, then taxpayers may be disappointed. James Close of Ernst & Young was seconded to the Treasury under Gordon Brown as head of corporate and private finance. He sees only limited scope for savings in PFI costs.
The main source of savings here can come from the reprofiling of the service agreement. So there has to be some benefit that comes to the service provider of a reduced cost from delivering a different level of service.
You mean you cut back on what has to be provided by the contractor?
Exactly. You may clean once a day instead of twice a day. All of the debt financing has already been established in the construction cost, so you're then looking at the service element of the annual payment charge. And you're able then probably to squeeze out 1% to 2% of that total annual charge.
Only 1% or 2%?
Which is material and worth having.
It's worth having, but not earth-shaking.
Exactly.
As for the idea that companies making big profits selling PFI shares should give some of this money back to the taxpayer, James Close, again, doesn't want to raise hopes.
Does the taxpayer have any right, either in law or morally, in your view, to a share in equity sale gains?
In law, it's almost certainly not. Morally, well, there's a case, I think, to be made that there have been some super profits here. But these bidders entered into these contracts in good faith, and they would expect the contracts to be honoured in good faith. And therefore, I think it's difficult to make a moral case for an equity return to go back to the taxpayer around this, unless it's done on a shared basis.
So the government could try to persuade the contractors to give over some of their equity sale profits, but they have no power to enforce that.
That's exactly right, and many contractors or equity holders don't need to embark in that process really at all. There's nothing in it for them.
So they can just keep the money.
Exactly.
So what future does the PFI programme have? The scale of government scorn might suggest that the party is over, except for the small matter of hundreds of contracts already committed to payments over the next 30 years or so. But dozens of new PFI projects are still being procured under the coalition. Research by the public sector union Unison has discovered 61 new contracts with a total value of almost £7 billion. David Metter of the PPP Forum accepts that government statements are openly antagonistic. The reality, he believes, is that PFI remains irreplaceable.
All governments will need to invest in public services infrastructure, and particularly now, when we find ourselves in a period of austerity, investing in infrastructure is investing in the future growth of the UK. So I would expect it to become very important to the current coalition to have an infrastructure programme. And that programme will be delivered by the private sector, and it will be financed by the private sector. And this is effectively PFI. It may change its name.
It sounds as if you're saying that the politicians can say what they like, and they are saying some very hostile things about PFI and even about you. But you've got them over a barrel, because if they want the projects, they're going to have to use PFI.
Well, they're certainly going to have to use the private sector to deliver new infrastructure projects. The private sector is efficient, and it has demonstrated during the past 15 years that it can deliver 700 projects on time and on cost, and it would be extremely surprising if the government decided to do it another way.